From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 510, DevOps in 2016 with guest Gene Kim, recorded Tuesday, November 1st, 2016. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio, bringing back one of my favorite guests in the world. It's Gene Kim, the author of The Phoenix Project, which is a novel about IT DevOps and helping your business win, and now the new DevOps Handbook. He's been studying high-performing IT organizations since 1999 and was the founder and CTO of Tripwire for 13 years, and now is just focused on the DevOps thing all the time. This book, sir, has been coming for 3 years? 4 years?
It's worse than that, Richard. It's 5.5 years. Wow. In fact, I think we may have talked before that this book was actually supposed to come out before the Phoenix Project. Wow, and it was just so clear that as the Phoenix Project was heading towards publication in January 2013, you know, there was just no way this book was going to get done in time. And my personal feeling was that, you know, it was just, there was so much I didn't understand yet. And I'm so glad we took that extra time. And, you know, I guess one of the things I'm proudest of is that, you know, there are 48 case studies in the book, and so much of those came from learnings that came after the Phoenix Project. Sure. And a lot of them came out of the DevOps Enterprise Summit. And I'm just so delighted there are so many concrete case studies that aren't just Microsoft, Amazon, Google, the cloud providers. But,
yeah, you know, the unicorns, right? I mean, we talked about this earlier in 2016, that we're getting past the unicorns now. It's not just magical fairy companies that are able to iterate like this and really have their teams work so tightly together. The regular, everyday software companies work like this too.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I mean, they're not even what people would call software companies. They're just regular companies, right? Like Nordstrom, Target, Capital One, Raytheon. And what's so great is that they were able to chronicle those stories, too. So, you know, I haven't done a precise count on this, but I think of the 48 case studies, only about 12 or 15 of them are the unicorns. The rest are, you know, large, complex organizations. And it's been so great to chronicle their journey.
Right. Companies that existed long before the computer-dominated business.
Yeah, exactly. I mentioned that the DevOps Enterprise Summit that we did in London, we had Barclays presenting, which was founded in the year 1643, I think.
Love it.
And then the UK HMRC, which was founded in the year 1200. So so taxation policy goes back, you know, over 800 years. So, you know, that's not in the DevOps handbook, but it just shows that these are such universal patterns.
Yeah, been around a long, long time.
Exactly.
But it is interesting to see just the such high yield around the benefits. You know, the line you use here, just taking off the back covers, 2.5 more times likely to exceed profitability, market share, and productivity goals. Like, just that this is that big of an advantage.
Oh yeah. In fact, you had Nicole Forsgren, dear friend and colleague, who I worked on the benchmarking, the State of DevOps report with. It's not just IT performance of deployment frequency and lead time and change success rate and mean time to repair, but it's also organizational performance as defined by ability to exceed profitability, market share, and productivity goals. But this year, we found a couple more things. We found that the high performers, the employees at these organizations, were 2.2 times more likely to recommend their places to work to friends and colleagues as a great place to work. And, you know, that's called the Employee Net Promoter Score. And that, there's a whole bunch of research to show that that is highly correlated with increased revenue growth, increased profitability. That's, and it's so tightly attached to almost every VP of HR cares about, which is retention and culture scores.
Yeah.
And there's security benefits. High performers spend one half as much time remediating security incidents because they're integrating security objectives into every stage of daily work. So, you know, it's just great on, you know, almost every dimension possible.
Yeah, it's almost too comprehensive to get your head around all of the things we're talking about here. And we, in the past, I've talked about the challenges of actually being able to incorporate security as part of this process. So it seemed like the dev and the ops guys got it. That was good. Now it was the security and the management folks that were sort of struggling with, can we iterate this quickly? Can we experiment reliably? You know, have we lowered the cost of failure enough that we can afford to move that fast?
Exactly. And I think, you know, that's one of the goals of the DevOps handbook is to really show, you know, how does every constituent in the value stream, whether it's dev, test, ops, infosec, product owners, leadership, the business owners, you know, what is their respective roles in a more DevOps style of work? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess one of the big learnings for me that, I struggled with and, you know, it was a real aha moment for me. It was really around Conway's Law. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's tough to go to a DevOps conference without hearing some mention of Conway's Law. But, you know, for me, it was, I think I sort of understood it from a conceptual level, but, you know, how it would impact our daily work was a little bit elusive. And one of the sections I love the most is about the Etsy Sprouter thing. So, you know, for those of us who can't recite Conway's Law by heart, it's often paraphrased by the gentleman who wrote The Cathedral and the Bazaar. He said, you know, if you have four teams working on a compiler, you'll get a four-pass compiler. So that's, I think, a wonderful simplification of Melvin Conway's original statement that he made in the 70s. But, you know, there's a wonderful example at Etsy, one of the unicorns, allegedly, but it was so great because it showed how Conway's Law can help or hurt us. So back in 2008, they had this problem where to implement any piece of business logic, you had to have two teams do work. You had the developers working on the PHP on the front end.
Right.
Then you had to have the DBAs working on the stored procedures and Postgres on the back end. And so, you know, you have two teams and two places where work is performed, right? Yeah. So, yeah, there was this vision of making it possible to decouple their work. So the idea was that you have the developers working on the front end, you have independently of the back end, and they'll meet in the middle in something that they called Sprouter. And that was called a stored procedure router. So the problem was that now in order to implement functionality, you went from having two teams required to do work to having three teams. And there's this wonderful phrase about, it said it required a degree of communication and coordination that was rarely achieved to the point where every deployment became a mini outage.
Right.
And so, you know, so this shows us that, you know, as we go from two teams to three teams, right, you know, all sorts of bad things happen, increasing the need for communication, coordination, prioritization, signaling, marshaling, and so forth, right? So as part of the great Etsy transformation, there was an effort to kill Sprouter. And so the goal was to make it possible for any piece of business functionality to be developed just in the front end. They used object relational mapping so that developers could just create the changes in the PHP code. And so the outcomes are remarkable. The amount of communication and coordination went down from, you know, significant to worse to none, right? Because teams could do it independently.
Right.
The lead time went way down. The reliability went way up. But more importantly, it enabled developer productivity. Small teams could now independently develop, test, and deploy value to the customer without having to communicate, coordinate, signal, marshal.
So I'm sorry, less planning resulted in more product?
Yes, exactly, because they didn't have a bottleneck on the Sprouter team or in the DBAs. And it just shows us how profoundly Conway's Law can hinder our objectives or, you know, better yet, you know, help us achieve those goals. So I love that. And it really shows this kind of other element of DevOps, which is, you know, how to enable small teams to independently develop, test, and deploy independently without being shackled to tens or hundreds of other teams, which is, you know, I think so much of the hallmark of, you know, large complex organizations where everything's tightly coupled together.
So it strikes me then that this is all about building vertical integration, that all of the different skills necessary to develop and deploy, put a piece of software into the world needs to be a team.
Yeah, I think that's one interpretation. I think there's one implementation. You know, mm-hmm. I think there's so many patterns that fulfill this as well, right? Like whenever you have a platform as a service or infrastructure as a service where people can get things on demand,
right?
Where you don't have to rely on, you know, say the infrastructure teams to get what they need. You know, you can see the same thing with test data management, right? How do you enable developers to, you know, get representative data sets so they can do, you know, production-like testing on production-like data sets. Yeah, I think the opposite is maybe more obvious, is whenever we require teams to open up four or five different sets of tickets to get their work done, I think that's what we're trying to avoid. Or, I heard this other example that just blew me away. It was by Rich Hickey. He's the inventor of a language called Clojure. It's a Lisp-like language. And he was giving a talk and he said, Have you ever been in that situation where you just wanted to change a class name or you just wanted to change a class and you had to take basically everybody in the entire organization out to lunch, right? That's also another manifestation of the coupling problem.
Yes.
And when I saw that, I'm like, oh my gosh, yes, sometimes it's even inherited in the languages we use, right? Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's huge that you get these big it seems like a small change, but it is an incredibly large cross-cutting concern.
Yeah,
so
right.
Everybody right. now has essentially a say in any of those decisions.
Right, exactly. I thought that was so subtle, right? Because you don't open up tickets to change your class name. It's just that you can't without getting approvals from like every team, in the organization.
Right. And they really have no incentive to give approval.
Right. Like exactly. Right.
The only thing that giving approval does is increase their risk that they were part of a failure.
Right. To do something that some dumbass on the other side of the building wants to do that I don't care about.
Yeah.
And it's funny, right? The countermeasure there is stop passing classes around. Pass instead just the underlying data structures, right? Because now you've just escaped from that dependency. For me, it was probably one of the biggest aha moments of the year. Was like, holy cow, I wish that could have been made into the book. But yeah, coupling comes in so many ways, shapes, and forms. And the goal is, how do you liberate teams so that they are not shackled by people who don't care about your problems as much as you?
Right. And I think that's the biggest thing. Like, I'm thinking back to the Etsy story about, as we added more teams that were responsible for building this application, it became impossible to actually do that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you don't necessarily want to eliminate all the people, right? It's like, get rid of all the DBAs. That just seems foolish.
Oh, no, right, exactly. No, the no DBA. There are plenty of things. I mean, the entire Etsy site still, like so many great properties on the planet, run on MySQL, right? Sure. There are no DBAs disappearing. Instead, it's how do you enable teams, whether it's developers or testers or security people, how do you enable them to be productive? And the answer is almost never, to force them to open up a ticket every time that they need something done, right? So it's not about getting rid of the people. It's how do you enable those other teams? How do you automate those things?
Right. Well, it strikes me that I still want somebody managing the database. I still want support in that area. I just want them to be able to provide me access to data as a service, so that they're not having to write code every time I need to write code.
Right. Exactly right. And so, you know what? There's some things I just love about this story is that, and I'll just expose some of my own biases, right? When I was at Tripwire for 13 years, we were trained, by our salespeople, right, to always ignore the architects, right? They're those useless people who, dig out Visio 2003 once a year, draw a nice diagram, and then they crawl back into their ivory tower once a year, right? Never to be seen until the next year, right? They would, and I think that was just a real way of saying these people never influence daily work. And yet now, right, it's so clear to me that architecture is a top level leadership and management concern, right? I mean, if you want engineers to be productive, how can you do that without the right architecture?
Right.
I mean, if you choose the wrong organizational structure, if you choose the wrong architecture, nobody can get work done, right? you need, to mobilize 20 different teams to get, one line of code implemented to develop a feature, right? It's just, and I think the other kind of aha moment was that organizational design and architecture, have to be congruent. And if not, we've achieved neither the architectural goal nor the organizational design goal.
Yeah. Funny that.
Yeah.
You're actually further away from all of the things.
So you say that, but for me, it was very much a profound aha moment that, until that moment, I don't think that fully sunk in. And I think that's just sort of like one of the million things that, I learned. It seems so obvious now. And yet for me, it was just never made that concrete. So for me, it was just a big learning.
Yeah, sure. And this goes back to, I think it was Fred Brooks who issued coined Conway's Law as a term back in Mythical Man Month.
That's so true.
Adding more people to this makes it worse, not better.
Yeah, and you know what I love? In fact, I love that Etsy Sprouter story so much that I think it will be taught in 10 years. It will be taught in MBA curriculums because leaders need to be taught this, right? Is that how important it is in any technology organization about architecture and how we organize our teams? Because it has a disproportionate effect on the outcomes that we get.
Yeah.
And you're right. It goes back many years, but boy, I just... I think these problems of all are now orders of magnitude more important because it takes so few people to get work done.
Yes.
Right. Compared to the older days where everything was harder, everything took longer, more people, more effort, more calories, et cetera.
Yeah. So all of these things were harder to do now. And I guess a part of that is just wondering, like, is it because we're able to move as fast that we need to? Why is this turning out so much better this way that we're having all this additional power? It makes me wonder how we ever built software in the past.
Yeah, that's a great question. Just off the top of my head, I think there's two things happening. But I think the big pressure point that we just didn't have before are these insanely fast iteration times, right? When it is possible. I love this quote that came from Aidan Cockcroft that made it into the book. You know, he said in the 70s and 80s, you know, any major initiative, you know, would take $100 million. You'd have a year. And if you screw up, you know, you could bankrupt the company. And by the, you know, 90s and the 2000s, you know, with distributed computing and, you know, with these more modern development frameworks, it took maybe millions of dollars and, you know, just took the CIO's approval. And these days, right, you can get things done, you know, in weeks, right? Yes. And the worst thing that can happen is that you have an embarrassed product manager.
He had a bad quarter. That's all, in terms of yield. That's all.
Yeah, no, exactly right. And when you have the right culture, you know, they might even be, that's not even something to be embarrassed about, you know, if it created some genuine learning.
Yeah, you're still some asset from that.
So I think when you, when the cycle times, you know, shrink to that extent, I think that exposes a lot of these problems that you could just, you know, would always be hidden when you have these year-long projects. I think the other thing is that when you have smaller teams that are capable of doing real work, now you have the need for work to be done simultaneously, without excessive ritual and synchronization and marshaling and coordinating, right? Because, you know, done wrong, yeah, now you'll have, you know, 100 teams that are basically shackled together and you're back to a yearly release.
Yeah.
I think now more than ever, this need to liberate those teams, make them productive, is more important than ever. It just becomes very obvious when at the extremes, right? If you have hundreds of teams working independently, all getting their work done, that is very, very different and obvious when, you know, no one can get things done because everyone's waiting for a stored procedure change or agree on the next class version, right?
Or some other variation of this gridlock that yeah, happens exactly. Within the team. Gene, give me one second here to pay the bills because this episode of Run As Radio is brought to you by UpGuard. In the aftermath of data breaches, the public is often told we couldn't have seen it coming. But in a lot of cases, that's just not true. Over 80% of breaches have their root in misconfiguration, whether it be a firewall rule, server setting, open port, or third-party service. UpGuard is the premier system of record for IT configurations, no matter the platform, pinpointing anomalies and surfacing unauthorized changes in critical systems around the world. See how it works and get a live, customized demo at upguard.com/runasradio. Can we dive a little into the book? I mean, parts of this reminds me of the Phoenix project, just from the sense that there are the three ways. And the three ways are always there. It's just that I feel like this is really well organized. And you introduce the three ways up front, and then you dive deep on each of the ways.
The book is organized exactly as you said, and there's one more section in there about like choosing where to start.
Right.
We use the Nordstrom mobilization example as, again, we try and weave the case studies directly into the narrative. In fact, what was kind of a big stylistic change that we debated a lot on, we actually moved a case study into the beginning of each chapter. So I love that because mm-hmm. I think, you know, kind of as human beings, we're organized to, you know, appreciate and hear stories. And so just using that as a way to sort of set the stage. So, you know, where and how do you start? Kind of what are the tactics and strategies? You know, how do you not get fired while doing this?
Yes.
And then there's a deep dive into each one of the three ways, both from the principal's perspective, where we really lean on the manufacturing body of knowledge. And so we make a very specific decision not to dive deep into the technology, but kind of really ground everything into how is this valid in the manufacturing world. And then I learned so much there too. And so, yeah, I think you got little bits and pieces of that in mm-hmm. Kind of Eric's hand waving in the Phoenix project. And then kind of the last part of the book, the last half of the book is really about the technical practices. The first way is, you know, how do you build the foundations of a continuous deployment pipeline? What does version control look like? And really define it, you know, for ops people who may not have used it on a team project where they have to work with developers.
Yeah. I mean, most developers are familiar with source control to some degree, but often their operations people are not. And there are elements of what operations do, DBAs as well, that need to be part of source control.
Oh, absolutely, right? Because we want repeatability, we want rollback, all these things. And, you know, with things like Team Foundation Server and Visual Studio Online, I was like, you know, version control is built into everything now, right? And even for developers, right? You know, it's like, what really goes wrong when when developers don't check in and merge, right?
Right.
I mean, I just, you know, what is the plural of developers? You know, merge hell, right?
Yeah.
It's like, what is just all the things that go wrong when you have tens or even hundreds of developers all working on the branches and then merging at the end, right?
Yeah.
Nothing works, right? And it takes weeks to unwind everything, or not unwind. There is no unwinding. It's how do you make everything work when it's all integrated together? So the second way is all about production telemetry, and how do you build, what does a telemetry architecture look like? What are advanced practices we can use to detect variants ever earlier in the problem detection cycle, going into statistics? And then, you know, how do we integrate that into daily work so that the developers can increasingly do their own deployments and do their own tests? And the third way is all about creating a culture of continual learning. And I think that chapter was really rewarding for me. It's really about, you know, how do leaders create the rituals that go away from blame and more about accelerating learning, because the name of the game now is that organization who learns the fastest will win in the marketplace. So that's all about creating internal technology conferences. It's going to more conferences in general. There's this quote I love from a gentleman at Nationwide Insurance. He said, for the 8,000 associates at Nationwide, for technology associates, you know, the most important thing is to learn every week, right?
Right?
If you can't learn something that week, then teach something that week. And it's just, boy, you can imagine how amazing it is to work in an organization like that, where there's such a value placed on learning.
It just, you know, the first two ways really got you there, right? That able to deploy quickly and reliably, able to gather feedback in detail so you know how you did. And now you third way get to experiment. And that challenge to cultivate a culture where we want to, you know, experiments are only interesting if something goes wrong.
Right, right. And so to go back to the principles, right? There's like, there was this famous Toyota supplier called ASIN, among the other things. They have a division called the ASIN mattress division, and they make all the seats for the Toyota cars.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they would routinely do experiments. It's very expensive to expand capacity. So, you know, when they have slow days, what they would do is they would go from, you know, they might have, say, two lanes to build a certain type of a part. They would actually try to stress test a lane by moving all the work to one lane, right? To see if there's a way that they could increase capacity.
Interesting. Well, and that mostly says figure out where the bottleneck is. Like, where are we breaking down?
Exactly, right? And they could fail safe, right? Is that
right.
If it doesn't work, they just flip back, you know, to open up both lines again.
Yep.
And so the principle there is like, how do you continually introduce tension into the system so that you can force the emergent improvements? And when I read this, I was like, holy cow, that's like Chaos Monkey, right? That's like the famous Netflix example of deliberately injecting faults in the production environment so you can reveal those.
Keep killing services to see if you're actually resilient. You'll only really know if you kill services.
Exactly. So, you know, when you don't have enough failures and things going wrong to learn from, you create those failures to accelerate learning. Oh man, is that cool or what?
I just love
the analog.
But something so analog, something so, you know, it was a factory. That they actually were stressing the factory to see, well, where does this actually fall down? But I also like that everybody's on the same side of that problem. Even the folks that are on the line struggling to do all of that work are still on the same side of the problem of where, you know, I'm struggling to keep up of where are we actually breaking down on this.
You know, and one of my heroes is Dr. Stephen Spear. So he's famous for this famous Harvard Business Review paper he wrote called Decoding the DNA of the Toyota Production System. He wrote a book called The High Velocity Edge, which is probably one of the most cited books in the DevOps Handbook. Researchers call it dynamic learning organizations, of which the Toyota Production System is one. The Toyota suppliers are another. The Pratt & Whitney engine design team is another. Anyway, he said one of the common characteristics is that because they are introducing problem solving and, you know, what looks like crises into daily work, when real crises happen, it's just another day, right?
So everybody knows what to do.
And there was a breathtaking example that I loved putting into the book was there was a famous fire, I think it was in 1982, where a brake pad manufacturer, it was a sensor that goes into the brake assemblies, burned down. And so the Wall Street Journal wrote, this could be the end of Toyota because there's no inventory in the supply chain. They may stop making cars, for weeks or months. And what ended up happening was very surprising is that, Toyota was able to mobilize its entire supplier network. They ended up being able to reproduce, the suppliers were sharing plans so they could, have another line building equivalent parts within days. Hmm. And they were actually working in, some sort of impaired production state within a week. So, when everyone is good at swarming and mobilizing to fix problems, even something that might have killed another company, they could recover from, within days or weeks. When, the Wall Street Journal was predicting that this could have been the demise of, Toyota, this would inject grievous harm to the company. Amazing.
Well, and again, it's like really resilient organizations. You only see resiliency when they get bent.
Right.
As long as, but it's interesting that, human nature is to generally seek comfort, not stress.
Yes. And there's another narrative that says as human beings, we love solving problems, right? That what makes a life worthwhile, right, is lifelong learning. And for that, we want challenge, right? We want autonomy and challenge, I think is what Daniel Pink says. And so things like Chaos Monkey, things like Game Days are actually, for many of us, right, actually create challenge and joy.
But we only get into that once we've got sort of the core things cared for, right? Like if you've got your organization to a place where you can afford to be experimental, psychologically, where there is that failure is not a career-ending event, then you do want to press against you. Yeah, and I think Pink's term was mastery. Mm-hmm. You want to press against your mastery to actually find new limits.
I love this. Oh man, this is like one of this. This sounds like such a humble and like boring and non-laudable story. But one of the things I loved, this came from a gentleman from Australia. He said, so here was our Chaos Monkey in this large complex environment. He said, we had this problem where no one would patch their servers because everyone was afraid that would never come back up again.
Right.
And so his little mini Chaos Monkey was, everybody, I'm going to power down your servers sometime next week. I gave you a week to get ready. And then, sometime during a scheduled period, right, I'm just going to turn them off and we're going to measure how long it takes for you to get back up again. And it went from like hours down to an hour down to minutes. And what that exposed was this very critical capability of like confidence that you could change and patch your servers so that you could, not get hacked, right, and be totally compromised. And that hinged upon, right, just this kind of very basic drill of I'm going to, your servers are going to go down at an inopportune time.
your servers are going to be turned off. That's going to happen anyway. So that's now off the table.
Yes.
You know that's going to happen. Now what are you going to do, right? You're sort of taking it to the next level.
Isn't that amazing?
It's such a good idea. I mean, we see these practices over and over again. I've worked with an organization in the Caribbean that always dealt with hurricanes. And so their whole problem was that failovers were going to happen a couple of times a year no matter what. But as long as they're only happening a couple of times a year, they never got good at them.
Right, right.
It was only by doing them every month, whether they needed to or not, that they got good at them. But it turns out that being good at them meant that your best people weren't working on it.
Right, right, right.
That it became so routine, it wasn't that interesting anymore. Like as long as only the rocket scientists actually get to do any of this stuff, it's never routine. It's always special. It's almost like you need to make it not special.
Yeah, I love this because I heard a similar story from a large oil refiner, and this came from the security person. It's like, hey, look, I get it. These are the plant managers, the refinery managers, and like I get it that we can't apply this patch because you can't afford the 7 hours of downtime. So let's forget about security. We just got to get better at rebooting.
Nice.
Because we can't install upgrades, we can't patch. And it's just, I love it just because, sort of like John in the Phoenix Project, it looks like John has lost his mind, right? John doesn't care about patching. John instead cares about rebooting. And yet, from a systems perspective, right, that really does make sense. It's like rebooting is a prerequisite for safe patching.
Yeah. And until you can get good at rebooting, you're never going to be good at patching anyway.
Just to wax off topic for a little bit. I mean, what I love about DevOps is that it's so counter to the common practice. It's so almost controversial, right? Because you know, even now, I just love the fact that, you know, this my desktop, it hasn't been rebooted in, you know, 8 months. But yeah, how in reality, right? That's terrible, right? It's we want things to be immutable, you know, instantly reproducible. You know, this is not a good behavior. You know, even some of these deeply loved metrics, right, of like uptime and, you know,
yep.
And we have to abandon them for something totally different, the opposite.
Yeah, it is very kind of, and you mentioned Adrian Cockcroft before, but he seemed to grab onto this very early on, this very counterintuitive way of thinking about, oh no, we'll disrupt routinely. You know, we will always shake these things up because then we actually see the consequences of it and then we can respond to it. The trick is actually to do it in an environment where, again, that's not a career limiting behavior. That you actually see the value of that, that you recognize we actually get better. And that's back to that. Are we able to measure effectively? Do you know when you're better? What does better look like to you?
Yeah. And for me, it was just very satisfying from an intellectual perspective to be able to trace that back, these stories in manufacturing, where we can just see the validity of that. We're like, oh yeah, that is amazing, mm-hmm. right? It's like, I understand it and it generates awe. And then to make the sort of isomorphic mapping to the technical patterns of, you know, like Chaos Monkey or Reboot Monkey, you know, it's just, for me, it was a very intellectually satisfying, and, you know, awe-inspiring part of the work.
Yeah, when you look at Chaos Monkey on the surface, you go, that's the craziest piece of software I've ever heard of. You do what? But you have to know the path there to suddenly realize, oh, actually, I need that. That's something that makes a difference to my organization, makes it stronger.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gene, a half an hour has disappeared again, but really fun to talk to you. Super excited to see the book at long last and be able to share it out with the world.
Thanks, pal. It took a long time, but hopefully it was worth it. In fact, I'm delighted we took the extra time, and I could be happier.
You made a better book as a consequence.
Absolutely.
It begs the question, of course, what's next? You got another one in mind?
Starting to work on the next project. I can't talk a lot about that, but let's just say that State of DevOps report is coming out for 2017, yes. And working on the next book, and maybe I can tell you more about that later.
I suspect, knowing the pattern you and I have been working on the past few years, I'll be talking to you early in 2017 about what you saw last year and what the new report looks like.
Sounds good. And by the way, congratulations on all your great work on the humanitarian toolbox. I mean, it's just, it's so great to see cognitive surplus, being used in so many amazing ways to help the human condition for people who need it the most. It's just great.
Oh, thanks very much, sir. It's fun to find ways where everybody wins, you know, where developers get to donate their skills, operations guys get to run software that's really meaningful. We get to take work off the hands of these NGOs that are trying to save lives so that they can have software that just works for them. And, ultimately the goal is to help folks that are affected by natural disasters around the world get back into their homes, get back to their lives in less time. And, you know, I think I'm hoping we get to a place where we can see the metrics of the software is making a difference in keeping people alive and happy.
Hey, I can't wait to interview you on the humanitarian toolbox. So,
those conversations are happening, but it's still early days. There's a lot to do.
Awesome. Keep us posted. And thanks again, Richard. This is always such a blast and hilarious talking about these things that are the shared experience that so many of us have lived through.
Absolutely. Gene Kim, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.